The young man at the computer suddenly screamed, "Oh, shit!"
"What is it?" Iwaki asked.
"The fucker planted a bomb in the software."
"Then why do you still have hands?"
"Not an explosive, a program that destroyed the files."
Iwaki turned to Beria.
"You have copies, of course?"
"I do not," Beria replied as firmly as he could manage. "I am not brilliant with computers, and I didn't try to view or copy the files."
Iwaki turned back to his techie. "Is there any way to recover the files?"
"No way at all," the young man replied. "If there were, I would know it. Whoever set this up was a genius at software."
"Did the bomb destroy anything else on the computer?" Beria asked.
"No," the young man replied.
"Your money is on the table," Iwaki said to him. "Now go and speak to no one about this."
The young man nodded, retrieved an envelope from the table, and departed.
"Now," Iwaki said, "two things. One, you owe me $20 million that I paid Bellini."
Beria stammered, "I will repay you. I'll need some time, though."
"Two," Iwaki said, "you get to decide who dies for this insult."
"I decide?"
"Only if you can't come up with the $20 million, and you can't tell me who is responsible for this."
"Bellini is responsible, and he is already dead, and his wife."
"Is it possible that Bellini made a copy without a bomb?"
"Entirely possible. Probable, even. It could fit on a large thumb drive."
"Who else would have known about this?"
"I believe there was another man in Bellini's apartment when Boris and I arrived," Beria said.
"And who would that be?"
"A lawyer named Barrington. When Boris and I got on the service elevator to leave, this man was already on it. He said he had come from upstairs, but I have come to think that was a lie, that he was in the apartment when Boris shot the Bellinis."
"I presume that you know where to find him?"
"I know where he lives in New York, but it is my understanding that he has half a dozen other residences in the U.S. and in Europe."
Beria took a sip of the water because his mouth had become dry.
"He also appears to be very well connected. His closest friend is the police commissioner for New York City, and he is also personally close to the President of the United States and her husband, and to the Secretary of State."
"Let me explain the situation to you," Iwaki said. "In anticipation of receiving this software, entirely on your assurance, I have hired a genius automotive designer and engineer and purchased a bankrupt motor car factory in England. I have ordered and paid for extensive equipment as well. My investment amounts to well over $150 million so far. Are you beginning to get the picture?"
"I understand," Beria replied, and clasped his hands together to keep them from trembling.
"There is more than your life at stake here, Stanislav," Iwaki said smoothly. "There is also the character and quality of your life during the lengthy period before you would be put to death. Do you understand me?"
Beria was unable to speak, so he nodded rapidly.
"Good," Iwaki said, rising. "I will give you 7 days to place the software in my hands, and when you do, it had better not explode, so to speak."
"I will need Boris Ivanov," Beria said.
"He will be at your side during your every waking moment," Iwaki replied. "He is waiting for you downstairs. Be here exactly 1 week from today with the intact software. If you can do it sooner, you will be rewarded."
Iwaki turned toward the stairway and started up.
Barrier managed to leave quickly without actually running. He retrieved his laptop and took the elevator down. When the doors opened, Ivanov was standing there, waiting.
"Your car is outside," he said.
"Thank you, Boris, but before we get into the car, let's take a little walk. I don't want my driver to overhear our conversation."
"As you wish," Ivanov replied, ushering Beria to the door.
When they had left the building, Beria motioned for his driver to follow them, and he began walking slowly up East 57th Street.
"I have some things to tell you," he said to Ivanov in Russian. "And it is most important that you understand me, because both my life and yours depend upon it. Do you understand?"
"Not yet," Ivanov said. "Perhaps you had better explain."
Beria began explaining. "The most important thing for you to know," he said, "is that whatever happens to me happens to you." He could see that he had the man's full attention.
45. Stone was in his office when Joan buzzed him.
"There is a Mr. Beria to see you, along with another gentleman," she said. "They do not have an appointment," she added pointedly.
"Are you on the handset?" he asked.
"Yes."
"Stall them while I call Mike Freeman."
Joan hung up the phone and addressed the two men before her.
"Mr. Barrington will see you, but he must first conclude a telephone conference call," she said to them. "Please, have a seat."
Beria pointed to the phone on her desk. "There are no lines lit up," he said.
"He is on a private line."
The two men sat down. Stone used his cell phone to call Mike Freeman at Strategic Services.
"Yes, Stone?"
"I need the protection we talked about yesterday. Specifically, I need four armed men here now. There are two men in my outer office that I do not wish to be alone with."
"I'll find people in your neighborhood," Mike said, then hung up.
Stone went to his safe and took out a Terry Tussey Custom 45 pistol, which weighed only 19 ounces, and a light shoulder holster, put them on, and donned his jacket. He had just resumed his seat when his office door opened and Beria and his gorilla entered the room.
"I see you have concluded your conference call," Beria said.
"Yes, I have," he motioned toward the sofa. "Please have a seat."
They did so, and he sat in a chair opposite.
"I believe we may have met before," he said, "but I can't remember where." "It was in an elevator," Beria replied. "Do you recall?"
"Ah, yes.
Let me come directly to the point," Beria said.
"Please do.
I believe you are in possession of a computer device given to you by Gino Bellini."
"Is that the same Bellini who was murdered in an apartment in the building where we met?"
"It is. And I have reason to believe that you were in the apartment when the murder occurred."
"I was in an apartment upstairs," Stone replied, "and in the elevator, of course."
"Mr. Barrington, if you stick to that story, things are going to become very uncomfortable for you very fast."
"That sounds very much like a threat, Mr. Beria."
"It most certainly is. Mr. Ivanov here is very accomplished at carrying out my threats."
Ivanov gave Stone a small smile. Stone produced the 45.
"How would Mr. Ivanov perform this duty with a bullet in his head?"
Beria looked very irritated. "Mr. Barrington, I possess the means to end your life before this day is out. I suggest you listen to my proposal before I take that step."
"Oh, you have a proposal. I thought you only made threats."
"I think a more business-like conversation would be in both our interests."
"Does Mr. Ivanov speak English?"
"He does, and very well."
"Good.
Mr. Ivanov, please remove the firearm from your person with your left hand and place it on the coffee table in front of you.
Ivanov looked at Beria and got a small nod. He placed the pistol on the coffee table. Stone reached over and swept it onto the floor.
Now you, Mr. Beria.
Beria opened his jacket to show that he was unarmed.
All right, now proceed with your proposal and take your time.
He thought he would like it if Beria was still talking when the Strategic Services men came into the house.
As I said earlier, Beria stated, I wish to retrieve the computer device given to you by Mr. Bellini.
I'm afraid you're not off to a very good start, Stone said, because I don't know what you're talking about.
Come now, Mr. Barrington, Beria said. You are being obtuse.
Stone shrugged. Please explain, and slowly, so that my dull wits may grasp your thought.
The device, probably a thumb drive, contains software that I purchased from Mr. Bellini for $20 million.
And you paid that sum before receiving the software? You're not a very good businessman, Mr. Beria.
Beria was beginning to become agitated.
Mr. Barrington, my associate in this matter is a Mr. Selwyn Owaki. Is that name familiar to you?
I believe it is, Stone replied, and you have my sympathy.
Your sympathy?
For finding it necessary to associate yourself with such a thoroughly disreputable person.
You are very fortunate that Mr. Owaki is not present, Beria said.
I agree. I certainly would not seek the company of such a man.
Mr. Barrington, you are wasting my time.
You come into my office without an appointment and make silly threats, and I am wasting your time? You are confused, Mr. Beria.
Beria was now turning red.
Now you listen to me, he began.
No, you listen to me, Stone said. I have the grounds to shoot you both right now, with no legal consequences.
There would be consequences beyond your imagination, Beria said.
All right, I'll play your inane game for a moment. Why do you think I possess this software?
Because you are associated with one Meg Harmon.
Are you referring to the Harmon who is the rightful owner of the software of which you speak?
I am.
Well, since she is the rightful owner and you are only a thief, we have nothing further to talk about, Stone said. Except you can tell Mr. Owaki that if he wishes to speak to me, not to send buffoons with messages. I'm in the Manhattan phone directory, if it still exists.
Stone's door suddenly opened, and four men filed into the room, each holding a handgun before him.
"Ah, gentlemen, welcome," Stone said. "There is a handgun on the floor over there. Please unload it, give it to the uglier of these two gentlemen, and then escort them both to the street. I expect they have a large black Mercedes waiting for them."
The four armed men followed Stone's instructions explicitly.
"You will be hearing from me, Mr. Barrington,"
Beria shouted as he was frog-marched from the room. 46. Joan came into Stone's office as he was inserting the little 45 back into its nest under his arm.
"What the hell was that all about?" she asked.
"You should excuse the expression."
"Should those two return," Stone said, "you have my permission to shoot them."
Joan kept a 45 of her own in her desk drawer.
"It would be my pleasure," she replied. "I hate rudeness in a man."
"Should you decide to do so, shoot first and think about it later," Stone said. "And I wouldn't be shocked if we received another such visit from a man named Owaki."
"Selwyn Owaki?" Joan asked, as if he were someone she had met at a bar.
"How is it that you know that name?" Stone asked.
"I read the New York Post," she said, "on occasion."
"And from your deep research, what is your impression of Mr. Owaki?"
"That he has an enormous amount of money, none of it honestly earned, that he is personally responsible for roughly half of everyone on the planet who dies of a gunshot wound, that he eats innocent babies for breakfast. She thought about it. Have I left out anything?
A great deal, Stone replied. For instance, you failed to mention that he uses the Russians' UN mission as sort of a branch office, which is the rock from under which our two recent visitors crawled, and that he derives a great deal of personal pleasure from the deaths of those whom he considers to be his enemies, which is pretty much everybody.
Why hasn't someone killed him?
Because he makes that work almost impossibly difficult.
He dwells in an area of a building he owns not all that far from here that no one can enter without a full body scan and considerable goosing of the private areas. Doesn't anybody know how to kill with their hands anymore? She asked.
Apparently not.
I don't know what the world is coming to, she said sadly. In my day, select people, secret agents, hired guns, Girl Scouts, who expected to sell their cookies without getting raped, were taught to kill with a single thumb.
Were you a Girl Scout? Stone asked.
Of course. How do you think I know this stuff?
Go bolt the front door and guard it with your life, Stone said, and tell Fred to be on his guard. He picked up the phone and called Dino.
Now what?
Dino asked, sounding exasperated. Well, for a start, the Russian guerrilla Ivanov has definitely not left the country.
And you know this how?
He just left my office in the company of Stanislav Beria and four of Mike Freeman's finest.
Why was he in your office?
He was supposed to intimidate me into giving Beria what he wants.
Which is what?
A computer thumb drive containing all of Meg Harmon's greatest hits.
The car without a driver?
Indeed.
And why does he think you have this thing?
Because I got it from Gino Bellini shortly before he was dispatched by these same two gentlemen.
I would get rid of it if I were you.
I've already returned it to its mother.
Then I would get her out of town.
I tried that once, remember?
I remember very well that your leaving town kept that awful thing from happening on my turf.
That's your only concern, isn't it? Moving it off your turf.
You guessed it, pal.
You're not concerned about my personal safety?
That's what Strategic Services is for. It's not my job to provide you with a personal police force, though you often seem to think it is.
I'm hurt.
Well, I hope you're ambulatory so you can get your ass moving. You do remember who Beria works for, don't you?
If I had forgotten, Beria and Ivanov were anxious to remind me.
Why didn't you have Joan shoot them?
I have already given her instructions to that effect, but a little late.
Timing is everything, Dino replied. That's why I'm telling you to take Miss Harmon and visit one of your many residences.
For how long?
Until somebody offs Selwyn Awaki, or you give him what he wants, whichever comes first.
Joan says she could kill him with her thumb.
I believe her, Dino said. Viv could probably do that, too. She says the Girl Scouts taught her.
That's what Jones says.
Enough of this banter, Dino said. Pick a house, pack a bag, grab your girl, and get your ass in gear.
I'll think about it.
Not for too long. I don't want to have to scrape you off a sidewalk somewhere in my fair city. Call me when you get wherever you're going.
Dino hung up. Stone called upstairs, and Meg answered.
Are you all unpacked? He asked.
Pretty much. Well, start packing again and bring your passport.
Why?
We have to get out of town all over again.
That didn't work out so well last time, did it?
I thought it worked out very well indeed, Stone said.
People died.
I don't mind that so much as long as it isn't you and me.
You have a point. How long do I have to pack, and what sort of climate have you chosen?
An hour. Cool and damp, with occasional sunshine.
I can handle that without major shopping.
Oh, and do you still have that thumb drive of Bellini's?
Yes.
Where is it?
In my purse.
Don't you have any pockets?
Certainly not. I'm a girl.
I forgot.
After last night?
You're not very observant, are you?
Ah.
Oh, all right. An hour. She hung up.
47. Stone completed his pre-flight checks and escorted Meg onto the airplane and into the right cockpit seat.
"Why can't I sit in the back like before?" she asked.
"Because Viv isn't there to hold your hand, and I don't want you to be nervous."
"What if I'm nervous anyway?"
"I've put you in the cockpit next to me so that you can absorb what goes into piloting a jet airplane."
"Well, that's something I don't intend ever to do."
"One never knows. Do one."
Stone handed her the checklist and commanded her to read it aloud to him, one item at a time. This took only about 3 times as long as if he had done it himself, but at least she was getting an idea of what was involved. That completed, he called the tower and asked for a clearance. A company called Pat Frank, after a woman who was a client of his, had already sent him a detailed weather report and filed his flight plans for this day and the next. Stone wrote down his clearance and entered his route into the flight computer. Then he called ground control and was given permission to taxi to runway 1.
"When do I get to know where we're going?"
Meg asked. "Today we're flying to St. John's in Newfoundland," Stone replied. "Tomorrow will be a surprise."
"Newfoundland?" she said.
"Brr." "You'll find it pleasant this time of year," Stone said.
He was cleared for takeoff, then taxied into position on runway 1, and pushed the throttles smoothly forward.
"Here we go."
A little longer than a moment later, he lifted the nose of the airplane, and it flew off the runway.
"That was kind of fun," Meg said.
"Next thing you know, you'll be taking flying lessons," Stone said, raising the landing gear and the flaps.
"Why can't you teach me?"
"Because teaching you to fly would require reserves of patience and kindness that I do not possess. It's better if you learn from a professional."
"Like learning to drive?"
"Yes, but there are fewer things to bump into."
At 450 feet, he pressed the autopilot button and took his hands off the yoke.
"What are you doing?"
she asked, alarmed.
"I'm turning the airplane over to the autopilot, which does a better job than I."
Stone received instructions to climb on course, and the airplane turned itself to the right.
"How long a flight?"
"A little over 3 hours. Would you like the New York Times?"
"I'd rather have a drink."
"We don't fly with alcoholic beverages aboard," Stone said. "The pilot might be tempted to have one, and we don't want that."
"Then I'll make do with the Times," she said.
He reached behind him, retrieved the newspaper, and handed it to her.
"Remember to look out the window now and then. The views are nice."
"What will we do in St. John's?" she asked.
"We refuel and check into a hotel for the night. I want to land in daylight tomorrow."
"Why? Can't you land at night?"
"Yes, but in the daytime the views are better."
They landed on schedule at St. John's, refueled, checked into a hotel, made love a couple of times, had a good breakfast early the next morning, and lifted off at 8 a.m. After a few minutes, Meg looked out the window.
"I don't see anything but ocean," she said.
"That's because we're crossing it."
"How long will it take?"
"About 3.5 hours. We have a tailwind of more than 100 knots, and that makes it fast."
"And where do we land?"
"That's the surprise."
Stone leveled off at flight level 410
and the airplane began to pick up speed. Soon they were at a true airspeed of 425 knots, but the tailwind gave them a ground speed of 650 knots. Stone selected some classical music on the satellite radio. "Eventually we'll run out of satellite and thus music," he said. "But it's calming my nerves. By that time you'll be as calm as you're going to get." Nearly 3 hours later, he pointed into the distance. "Land ho!" he said. Meg peered into the distance.
"I see it. Which land is it?"
"Ireland."
"Are we stopping there?"
"No."
"Well, the next country is England. Are we stopping there?"
"Yes."
"Where in England?"
"That's the surprise."
With Ireland behind them, air traffic control gave them permission to descend, and soon the south coast of England was beneath them.
"You're right," Meg said. "The views are lovely."
"I'm usually right," Stone replied. "Not always, but usually."
They got lower and lower.
"Are we about to land?"
"Yes."
"Where? I don't see an airport."
"Look dead ahead. You'll see a long strip of pavement with trees on both sides. There's a fairly large house to your left."
"I see the runway, but there's no airport."
"It's a private runway. During World War II, it was a bomber base for the RAF.
"I see several large houses. Which is yours?"
Stone pointed.
"The tour is over now. I have to concentrate on landing."
"But
Stone lined up for the runway, corrected for a slight crosswind, dropped the landing gear, and progressively added flaps, until a woman's voice said,
"500 feet.
"Who was that?" Meg asked. Stone didn't answer, but slowed to 110 knots and smoothly set down the airplane.
"We have arrived at Windward Hall," Stone said.
"Who are those people over there?" she pointed.
"The two gentlemen in uniforms are customs and immigration officials. The one in a suit is Major Bug, the estate manager."
Stone taxied up to the two vehicles, stopped, and shut down the engines. Shortly they were unloaded and were presenting their passports to officialdom.
"Welcome home, Mr. Barrington," one of them said.
They got into their vehicle and drove away. Stone introduced Meg to Major Bug, who had already put their luggage into a Range Rover.
"And the man driving the tug is George," Stone said as George towed the aircraft into its hangar.
Shortly they pulled up in front of Windward Hall, and help came to take their luggage to the master suite. Stone gave Meg a tour of the ground floor, and they were served drinks in the library. Major Bug gave Stone the Times of London and the local paper, and excused himself. Something caught Stone's eye at the bottom of the front page of the local paper.
"Oh, shit," he muttered.
"Really? My scotch is very good."
He showed her the story, which was about how a billionaire had bought a local car factory and saved the workers' jobs.
"Who is this man?" Meg asked.
"His name is Selwyn Owaki," Stone replied.
"And who is he?"
"He's the man we came all this way to get away from."
48. Meg stared at Stone.
"Who is he, and why did we come all this way to avoid him?"
Stone handed her the newspaper, and she read the article, then put it down.
"Selwyn Owaki sells arms to whoever has the money, and he doesn't care where or how they got it."
"He sounds charming," Meg said wryly.
"Actually, he has that reputation, when he's not murdering his competition. All sorts of people, even people who are very rich themselves, are attracted to and deceived by people who have vast quantities of money."
"Why is that, do you suppose?"
"It is one of the great mysteries of human nature. Americans particularly seem to suffer from this affliction." Haven't you noticed differences in the way you are treated by others since you became very wealthy? Well, now that you mention it, you'll have to learn to distinguish between people who simply admire your industry and those who hope to take some of it away from you, in one way or another. Selwyn Awaki is one of the latter group.
And what does he want from me?
The designs and specifications of your self-driving vehicles.
You mean he's the one who bought the stolen files from Gino Bellini?
Yes, but he dealt through Stanislav Beria, an official at the Russians' UN mission. Awaki always deals through others when doing something illegal, immoral, or both.
Ah, I think I see now why Mr. Awaki has bought an automobile factory.
Yes, and one not 5 miles from this estate. Stone tapped out an email to Mike Freeman, asking for protective measures to be taken for himself and Meg. I'm afraid we're going to become prisoners in this house until the issue is resolved.
Which issue is that?
Whether Awaki is able to lay his hands on your data, and whether he will try to kill us in the process.
I would prefer not on either account.
As would I. Don't worry. Mr. Awaki has no way of knowing we're here, and even if he did, by tomorrow morning Strategic Services will have established a cordon around the house to keep out unwelcome visitors.
Meg rummaged in her purse and came up with a thumb drive. So what he wants is this?
Yes.
She peered at it. Sorry. Wrong thumb drive.
She went through her bag again and came up with another.
This thumb drive.
Right. What's on the other one?
A draft copy of our quarterly report, she said. Actually, it could be quite valuable to someone with knowledge of it, since it is very favorable, and the stock price will shoot up when it's released in a few days.
I think we need to put the one containing the designs of the car in a safe place.
Where would you suggest?
A safe, Stone replied. Come with me.
He walked across the room and swung out a picture, the frame of which was hinged. Behind it lay a safe with a digital lock. Stone tapped in the code, asking Meg to memorize it as he did. Then he opened the door, stepped back, and allowed her to place the thumb drive on a shelf.
He locked it and returned the picture to its original position. Then they returned to their sofa and their drinks.
"This is a very beautiful house," Meg said. "How did you come by it?"
"A friend of mine, Dame Felicity Devonshire, who lives just across the Beaulieu River, spelled the French way but pronounced Beaulieu. I was in Rome on business, and I got a call from her asking me to come and visit her in England, that she had something to show me. That something turned out to be this estate. It was owned by Sir Charles Bowen, a delightful Englishman who was ill and slowly dying, and he wanted to sell the place to keep it from falling into the hands of either of his 2 children, both of whom he despised. Felicity brought me here to see the place, which was nearing the end of a complete renovation, paid for with money that would otherwise have gone to his heirs. She then arranged for Sir Charles and me to meet for dinner at the Royal Yacht Squadron, England's oldest yacht club in Cowes on the Isle of Wight, which lies a few miles from here across a body of water known as the Solent, an arm of the English Channel. Sir Charles and I got on famously, and at the end of our dinner I wrote him a check for his asking price, which I thought reasonable. The legal niceties were performed later. Sir Charles, who was living in a cottage on the estate during the renovations, died a few months later, sometime after I had moved in.
Dame Felicity must know you very well to know that you would want the house on sight.
Dame Felicity is director of the British Foreign Intelligence Service, known as MI6. She tends to know just about everything there is to know about everything.
Nevertheless, it was kind of her to steer you to it.
Her action was not entirely out of kindness. There was an element of self-service involved.
How so?
She didn't want the place to be snapped up by some nouveau riche hedge fund manager. She and her neighbors wanted someone who was the right sort of person to buy it, so she chose a nouveau riche American lawyer. Meg laughed. That means that she certainly did know you well. We have been friends for many years, Stone said. Why do I think that Dame Felicity is not a lady of a certain age and is quite beautiful? Because you are a perspicacious woman. Meg laughed. Will I meet Dame Felicity? The moment she hears we are here, she will invite us to dinner, or more likely invite herself here for dinner, so that she can get a good look at you. And I at her. I warn you, Felicity is something of a carnal omnivore, so don't be surprised if you find her hand on your knee. Meg laughed again. It's been quite some time since another woman tried that. At Stanford, I think. And she didn't get lucky. Just giving you a heads up, Stone said. His phone rang. Yes? Thank you so much. Goodbye. He hung up. At some time during the night, our guardians will be in place, so we may rest easily. I look forward to it, Meg said. 49. Stone showed Meg into the master suite, and then, after she had oohed and awed for a moment, into her dressing room and bath, where she repaired to unpack and undress. She was back sooner than he had expected, but he was glad to see her. He put aside his Times, and she shed her nightgown and dived into bed with him. "Aren't you exhausted?" he asked. "No, but I plan to be in just a few minutes," she replied, giving him a deep kiss and fondling him. "By the way," Stone said, "before I forget, you have filed all the patent application paperwork for your designs, haven't you?" "I expect so," she said, running a tongue in and out of his ear. "I gave the lawyers all that a long time ago." "Remind me to remind you to check with them first thing tomorrow to see if everything is in order." "Remind me to remind you," she said. And they gave themselves over to each other. Stone woke to a peep of sunshine through the closed drapes and checked the clock. 10 a.m. He had slept well, and Meg was still out. It was his turn to do the seduction, and he did so with relish. Breakfast was served in bed along with the papers, then the phone buzzed. "Yes?" Stone said into it.
"Good morning, Mr. Barrington. Major Bug here."
"Good morning, Major. Have you by chance ordered a parcel of security people to surround the house?"
"I have. Last night. I take it they have arrived." "They have. Shall I house and feed them in the cottage as before?"
This was not the first time this had happened.
"Please do, and give them every cooperation."
"Of course, sir."
The major rang off.
"Are we surrounded?" Meg asked.
"We are."
"Will that prevent me from taking a walk around the grounds?"
"When I said last night that we would be prisoners in the house for a time, I meant exactly that. However, you may explore the interiors of the house, which will take you much of the day."
"Oh, all right," she said. The phone rang.
"Yes?" Stone said.
A young man's voice said, "I have Dame Felicity Devonshire for you. Will you accept the call?"
"Certainly," Stone said. There was a click.
"Stone, is that you?"
"It is. The word spreads quickly."
"My spies are everywhere," she said. "I thought we might have dinner tonight, if you and your lady friend are available."
"How do you know that I am in the company of a lady?"
"Oh, really, Stone?"
"Come to us at 6:30, he said.
"That will work very nicely. I'm leaving the office a little early today. See you then."
She hung up.
"I think I can guess who that was," Meg said.
Good guess. She'll arrive at 6:30, dressed to kill. Never mind that it's just the three of us.
I'll do my best to rise to the occasion. Now, she said, leaping from the bed, I'm going to put on my country tweeds and explore the innards of the house.
How did you know to bring country tweeds?
A wild guess, she replied, and disappeared into her dressing room.
Stone read the Times fairly thoroughly, then gave up immediately on the crossword. He had never been any good at British crosswords. They were all riddles.
Meg was back at noon, while Stone was still dressing. "Wasn't I supposed to remind you of something?" she said.
"Yes, you were supposed to remind me to remind you to check on the status of your patent applications."
She looked at her watch. "Too early in California. I'll do it later."
"Remind me to remind you."
They lunched in the small dining room overlooking the rear gardens of the house. "Lord," Meg said, gazing at the riot of color, "what does it take to run a place like this?"
"About 15 people," Stone said, "and a bottomless bank account."
"What do 15 people do?"
"Well, there's Major Bug and his assistant, the cook and her assistant, 4 housemaids, a butler, and 2 of what used to be called footmen, but now prefer assistant butler. On the outside, a groom and his assistant, a gardener and his assistant, and 6 groundsmen, one of whom doubles as an aircraft handler and another as a dockmaster."
"That presumes a dock."
"Right over that way," he pointed, "on the Beaulieu River."
"That comes to 21, she said.
"Good God, as many as that?"
"You thought they were only 15.
"I would rather go on thinking that," Stone said. "Excuse me, I should check in with Joan." He called the New York house.
"Good morning, the Barrington practice."
"Good morning. Is everything and everyone safe and sound?"
"Yes, but Bob is a little put out that you didn't take him with you."
I didn't know on short notice whether the legal requirements for his entering Britain had been accomplished.
"Will you check into that?"
"Certainly."
"Anything at all odd going on?" "Do you mean the 2 men lurking outside in the street and the phone calls from men who, when told you are unavailable, decline to identify themselves?"
"I believe I do."
"Do you want me to shoot anybody?"
"Not until their hands are at your bodice. What you could do, though, is to tell Fred to take the car out once or twice a day so they'll think I'm in it. And tell him to watch his ass, in case they believe that too strongly, and take a shot at him."
"I will do so."
"Call me if there are developments."
"Of course."
They both hung up.
"Is all well?" Meg asked.
"As well as can be expected," Stone replied.
50.
Stone and Meg had just finished lunch when the butler came into the room.
"Excuse me, Mr. Barrington," he said, "but one of the security detail would like to speak with you at the front door."
"Please bring him in here," Stone replied. A man Stone recognized came into the room.
"Good afternoon, Mr. Barrington. It's Carl Atkins, isn't it?"
"Yes, sir. I have some rather unwelcome news for you, I'm afraid."
"And what is that?"
"The gentleman you're concerned about, Mr. Iwaki?"
"Yes."
"I'm very much afraid that he's a guest next door."
Stone turned to Meg.
"Next door means a larger country house, much larger than this one, that the Arrington Group turned into a country hotel."
"And it's next door?"
"Yes." "In the circumstances," Atkins said, "we feel strongly that you and Miss Harmon should not appear outdoors on the front side of the house, as Mr. Rowaki will certainly have his own security, and you might be spotted."
"How about the back side of the house?" Stone asked.
"That should be quite safe." Thank you, Carl. We'll heed your warning. Have a good afternoon, sir.
Atkins departed.
I suppose I was wrong about Iwaki being 5 miles away, Stone said. It's more like a quarter of a mile.
Swell, Meg said.
Would you like a walk in the garden?
That's at the rear of the house, he pointed.
Very much, she said.
They left the house through the rear entrance and walked into the garden, while Meg explained the species to Stone, who had no idea. Then they walked into the stable yard and had a look at the 4 horses there.
May we ride? Meg asked.
Do you ride?
When I'm permitted to.
I'm afraid our only trail passes within a few yards of the house next door.
I should have known. In that case, I think I'll spend the afternoon in your library with a good book.
What a good idea. Remember, drinks at 6:30.
I'll be there, suitably attired.
Stone was in the library at 6, dressed in a blue suit and a tie, remembering that Dame Felicity was often early. At 6:20, the butler announced her, and as soon as the door closed behind her, she enveloped Stone in a hug and allowed herself to be kissed on both cheeks.
"I won't ask how you are," Stone said, "because it's perfectly obvious."
"You too, darling," she said. She was dressed in a clinging cocktail dress of green, which set off her red hair.
"What would you like to drink?"
"A martini, please."
Stone went to the paneled bar and mixed the drink, then poured himself a bourbon. They settled into chairs beside the fireplace.
"I noted the presence of security at the dock and at the house," Felicity said. "May I know why?"
"You may," Stone said. He took 5 minutes to apprise her of the situation.
"Iwaki is a nasty piece of work," Felicity said. "In spite of his oleaginous charm, I knew he was in the country, of course, and now I know why."
"I don't think he came in search of us."
"No, it's his factory, and now I know why he bought it."
"I don't suppose you could find an excuse to have him thrown out of the country," Stone said.
"I'll see what I can do," she replied.
Meg was ushered in by the butler, and Stone introduced her to Felicity, who looked her up and down appraisingly. She was wearing a red sheath dress, and Felicity obviously approved. He made Meg a martini and Felicity a second one. Then they gathered at the fireplace.
"I understand you are in the intelligence trade," Meg said to her.
"I'm very much afraid that I can neither affirm nor deny that," Felicity replied. "I understand that you are receiving the attention of nefarious characters."
"I can affirm that," Meg replied. "Can you have people shot?"
"Not in my own neighborhood, I fear," Felicity replied. "I'm just across the river, you know."
"I have heard," Meg replied. "I don't know why Stone couldn't handle something like that himself," Felicity said. "There's a very good deer rifle from Holland and Holland right over there in his gun cabinet." She nodded toward it.
"Not in my own neighborhood," Stone said.
"Perhaps I should do it myself," Meg said. "I'm a very good shot."
"I would certainly have no objection," Felicity said. "But I can't speak for Her Majesty's government, who might take exception. In the nicest possible way, of course."
"Of course," Stone said.
"I could perhaps put in a word with the Home Secretary before your sentencing, though."
"How kind of you," Meg replied, and they all laughed. Dinner was a country pâté and pheasant from the estate, accompanied by a bottle of outstanding old claret from Winwood Hall's cellar, followed by Stilton and a vintage port. Stone was pleased to see that the two women got on famously, and Felicity had been a perfect lady.
"Now then," Felicity said over her second glass of port, "we must do something about your situation. I think it's appalling that you can't even take a walk or go for a gallop."
"What can be done?"
Stone asked. "The insufferable Mr. Iwaki believes himself to be untouchable," she said, "and I always enjoy upsetting the carts of the insufferable. Perhaps his new factory hasn't been subjected to the proper level of inspection by various departments of the county council."
"Since Iwaki is a new employer in the district," Stone said, "I doubt if they would wish to make him uncomfortable.
Still, he isn't actually building anything yet, is he?"
"The county newspaper says he is continuing to build the sports cars for which his factory is famous."
"And losing £10,000 on every one," Felicity replied. "That's why he was able to buy the concern cheaply. I think you're already doing the thing that will hurt him most, depriving him of the designs of what he would really like to build. You know, my board has discussed the possibility of manufacturing on this side of the pond," Meg said.
Stone smiled. "Perhaps they would vote to make Mr. Iwaki an insultingly low offer for the place."
"That would be very satisfying," Meg said. Felicity spoke up. "I could put you in touch with a British intermediary who would keep the source of the offer a dark secret."
"I'll make some calls tomorrow," Meg said.
51. Stone was taking a nap the following afternoon, paying the price for the good bourbon, claret, and port he had ingested the previous evening, when Meg came into the room and sat on the edge of the bed. "Stone, wake up," she said. He replied. "Open your eyes and ears. I have important news."
Stone opened one eye. "How much port did I drink last night?"
3 glasses, just like Felicity and I. Now listen to me carefully."
"I'm listening carefully," Stone said, opening the other eye.
"I've just spoken with my attorneys in San Francisco, and they told me that they filed for all our patents on the date I asked them to. However, upon checking, they find that they have no acknowledgement of that fact from the U.S. Patent Office."
"Well, that's all right. They will have confirmation of delivery from whatever shipping service they used."
"I'm afraid not," she said. "They sent it to the post office, along with all their other outgoing mail that day. Their mailroom has a record of it going out, but it was sent by ordinary mail, not registered mail. So there is no record of a notice of receipt from the patent office, who say that they have no record of it being filed."
Stone sat up in bed. "Your attorneys should have received a notice that would allow you to use the designation 'patent applied for.'"
"I'm afraid they didn't."
"Then your attorneys need to begin an immediate investigation of what happened to the package, questioning every employee who could have handled it."
"They are doing that now. My question to you is, if they can't find a notice of receipt, what is my position?"
"Your position in those circumstances would be a person or a corporation who has not applied for a patent."
"I was afraid you were going to say that. How can I fix this?"
"First of all, it's necessary that you officially become my client."
"Stone, will you please represent me as my attorney in all matters relating to all my company's products?"
"Yes. Now I need Joan to email us the correct paperwork.
But I don't want to wait until we receive it to start on this. May I proceed?" "You may proceed."
Stone called Joan and requested the emailing of an exclusive client retainer document. Then he called Bill Eggers, the managing partner of Woodman and Weld.
"Good morning, Stone," Eggers said. "Good afternoon, Bill. At least it is in England."
"I see. What are you up to over there?"
"Well, I've just signed a new client, Harmony Software of Silicon Valley fame, and its CEO, Meg Harmon.
It would be the firm's great pleasure to represent the company and Miss Harmon. Has she signed a retainer agreement?"
"It's being emailed to me as we speak."
"Good.
Well, I have a meeting to go to."
"Not yet," Stone said. Why not?
Because our new client's previous attorneys have fucked up royally, and unless we can sort this out in a hurry, the world may fall on both our new client and, by extension, us.
Explain, please.
Stone explained.
So, if this Iwaki fellow can get his hands on the designs, he could file a patent application?
I am very much afraid that is correct.
What is the name of the managing partner of her previous law firm?
Stone put his hand over the phone.
Who are your San Francisco attorneys and who is the top man there?
Coward, McMillan, and Crane, and John Coward is the senior partner and my attorney.
Stone conveyed that information to Bill Eggers. Then there was a knock on the door, and Major Bug's assistant entered the room with a thick stack of papers.
"This was just received from your office, Mr. Barrington," she said, "and we printed it out for you."
"Hang on a minute, Bill," Stone said, and put the phone down. "Meg," he said, handing her the pages, "this is our standard agreement for new clients. Please read it, then sign the last page."
Meg skipped to the last page, signed it, and handed it to Stone.
"Bill," Stone said, "I have Miss Harmon's signed representation agreement in my hand. I'll fax it to you."
He handed it back to the woman and instructed her to fax it to Eggers.
"Good. Now I will call John Coward, whom I know, break the news to him, and make unreasonable demands about locating the notice of receipt from the patent office. I will also send two attorneys from our San Francisco office to their offices to supervise the inquiry into what went wrong. Then I'll get back to you."
"Thank you, Bill." Stone hung up. "All right, Meg, you are no longer a client of Coward, McMillan, and Crane. You are now represented by Woodman and Weld under my direction."
"I feel better already,"
Meg replied.
"Not so fast. Don't feel better until we have fixed this problem. My managing partner, Bill Eggers, is sending two attorneys from our San Francisco office to your former law firm to find out what the hell happened. Then they will report to Bill, and he will advise us on how to proceed."
"All right," Meg said. "Now, may I join you for a nap?"
"Of course," Stone replied. Then the telephone buzzed.
"Yes?" "Mr. Barrington?"
Carl Atkins, the security man, said.
"There is a Mr. Selwyn Ozawi, a Mr. Selwyn Owaki here to see you. He does not have an appointment."
"Is he armed or accompanied by anyone?"
"No, sir, neither."
"Please ask the butler to show him into the library. Give him a drink, and tell him you will try to locate me."
"Oh, he wishes to see Miss Harmon as well."
"Tell him you will look for us both."
Stone hung up.
"What's going on?"
Meg asked. Stone got out of bed.
"Go and change into your riding clothes, tweeds, boots, etc. We are going to receive a visitor in the library, and we should look as though we have just come in from riding. If you have a perfume with a scent resembling horse sweat, spray a little of that on, too."
"And who are we receiving?"
"Selwyn Owaki. You have 20 minutes.
Meg ran for her dressing room, and Stone for his.
52. It had been Stone's experience that important people who have been kept waiting become angry and say things they might otherwise not say. So he kept Owaki waiting for nearly half an hour before sauntering into the library with Meg, chatting about their ride. Stone tried to look surprised to see the man.
"Oh, are you the gentleman who requested to see me, without an appointment?"
Owaki rose and tried to look pleasant.
"My name is Selwyn Owaki. I am a guest at your hotel next door."
He stuck out a hand, which Stone contrived not to notice.
"Please sit down, Mr. Ozaku, and tell me how I may help you."
"It's Owaki," the man replied, spelling it for him.
"Ah, yes. You're Japanese, are you?"
"I am not, sir.
I am of mixed extraction. Something of a mutt, huh? A touch of pink appeared on Owaki's cheeks. I have come to see you and Miss Harmon on a business matter. Oh, you know Miss Harmon?